Welcome to the Saturday Frights Podcast. I am the Projectionist, your co-host for this radio program. Now, come join your host, Vic Sage, as we enter the vault to once again discuss retro horror films and television programs.
Did you get it, Projectionist?
No! Blast its beady eyes! The infernal beast is too fast!
You do know this is your fault, right? Over there, in the corner!
How can you possibly consider this infestation something of my doing, Victor?
Watch his teeth! I don't know, Projectionist. Let's see. You start digging in your wing of the vault, and next thing we know, a horde of rats come pouring out. Green rats, man. Green rats. Is that even possible?
I will have you know, the black arts are not an exact science, Sage.
Oh, I know. That little trip through time sort of made that point clear. Now, instead of getting ready to record a new show, I'm doing my very best not to lose a hand to this thing.
Come now, show a little backbone. Besides, you would prefer losing body parts to what will happen to you if it manages to scratch you with its talons.
Hello?
Vic, it's Rockford.
Confound it all. Intern Rockford J, I thought I sent you into my wing to deal with these vermin.
I did, Projectionist. I don't think those cats you had me take are coming back, by the way.
Projectionist?
What? How else do you read vermin? Even those inflicted with ghoul fever.
Ghoul what?
What?
Put it out of your mind, dear boys.
Well, I just want to let you know the retroist had the Q branch come up with something. Yeah, I think that is doing the trick. Projectionist, I think you're going to have to wait until the containment teams are able to clean up your wing of the vault. How can rats write such vile words on the walls?
It just tore through the air duct, Projectionist. Rockford, you might tell the cleanup crew to keep an ear open for at least one loose vermin.
The retroist isn't going to like to hear that.
He will enjoy it far less if he is infected and begins to hear the baying summons of Ephesian, the mother of a million eyes, intern Rockford J.
I'll pass that along, Projectionist.
Rockford, you be careful down there, my friend.
Will do. Projectionist, Vic, good luck with the show.
Enough of that prattling.
Should I ask why you were doing something involving this million-eyed mother?
Look there, Sage. Upon the console, the recording light is on. It is time to once again entertain the dear listeners with our latest radio broadcasts.
Friends, thank you for joining us once again on the Saturday Frights podcast. Not sure how much you might have heard, but we have a little situation down here in the vault.
Oh, I am confident in saying that the threat is over. Mostly.
Well, we had a poll on the Saturday Frights Facebook page last month, asking you, the listeners, to vote on what the subject of this episode would be about.
Yes, Victor gave you all the option between a remake of Phantom of the Opera and Puppet Master. I still do not understand why we didn't offer the choice of discussing the original Phantom of the Opera with Lon Chaney, or even the 1943 remake with Claude Rains.
I told you, my friend, both the Robert Englund version of the Phantom and Puppet Master came out in 1989. The winner, and by a long shot, was Puppet Master.
This shall be an interesting broadcast. What with your fears of dolls?
I do suffer from pediophobia, projectionist, but that doesn't extend to puppets, I'm afraid. Especially when it concerns the characters, the puppets of the Puppet Master film franchise. This is sadly not a film that I caught in the local movie theater or drive-ins of my youth. I first saw Puppet Master thanks to one of those HBO free weekends. I was 16, I believe, and I can vividly remember seeing the promo clip for the film, advertising it was to be the next feature. It was just a little 10-second segment of some of the stop-motion effects from close to the beginning of the film. That moment when the puppet, Blade, frightens a woman.
Surely you had seen the works of Ray Harryhausen at this point, Victor.
Oh, absolutely. It might be apples and oranges when you get down to it, but I've always loved the David Allen style of stop-motion animation. There is quite a bit of realistic movement in the first three Puppet Master films. But David also worked on Joe Dante's The Howling, Barry Levinson's Young Sherlock Holmes, and Ron Howard's Willow, to name a few films. Not just stop-motion, of course, but puppet effects and other visual effects. By the way, when David graduated college, he actually went to work at the Clokey Studios, doing stop-motion work for both Gumby as well as Davy and Goliath. Friends, I am sad to say, though, he passed away at the way too young age of 54, back on August 16th, 1999.
I am indeed sorry to hear that, Serge. I will admit, while I am not as enamored with Puppet Master as you appear to be, the stop-motion effects do elevate this picture. Somewhat.
Don't get me wrong. I enjoy Puppet Master, but it's the fact they managed to capture lightning in a bottle with the second film, and then, when the third film came out, a prequel detailing how André Toulon, the true Puppet Master, fought the Nazis in World War II. The puppets go from being agents of terror to horror heroes, and birth a still-continuing horror franchise. I should also point out the continuity sometimes got retconned along the way. Actually, projectionist, it's safe to say the Puppet Master timeline is bizarre and more than a little fluid. I'll touch a little on that a bit later. Puppet Master was co-written by Charles Band, director David Schmoller, J.S. Cardone, and Kenneth J. Hall. Charles Band is a legend in the business. While he himself has directed 61 films in his career, he has produced 291 movies to date. He's produced everything from the criminally underrated Tourist Trap from 1979. David Schmoller was director on that picture too, to 1984's Ghoulies and 85's masterpiece Reanimator, and even 1986's Troll, as well as another H.P. Lovecraft adaptation, From Beyond. Those are just a few of the films he's had a hand in. I became a huge fan of Band thanks to his direct-to-video empire, Full Moon Productions, which replaced Band's Empire Pictures. I wasn't trying to make a pun there, by the way. From 1989 until the mid-90s, multiple movies were released to video stores under the Full Moon banner. And while they were low-budget, these films generally delivered solid genre pictures that created some memorable franchises, Trancers, Subspecies, and Demonic Toys, to name a few. Listeners, we fans of horror and sci-fi truly had something to look forward to back in the day with the library of Full Moon movies. In a way, Charles Band created something akin to the legacy of the Universal Monsters.
Blasphemy, Victor, of the blackest kind.
Okay, just sharing my thoughts on the subject matter. Why don't you go ahead and put down that cane? Please, save it for that little green monstrosity you've helped to unleash. In 1987, Charles Band produced a wonderful little horror film called Dolls. In interviews, he has said that he has always been interested in little things coming to life. And where that 1987 film had an army of dolls, with Puppet Master there are only five main puppets, Although, we do get to see a few more in the prologue. These include Jester, Pinhead, Tunneler, Leech Woman, and fan favorite, Blade.
Dear listeners, these are not your average puppets, but small harbingers of death. I feel I must point out that this Blade puppet bears a striking resemblance to actor Klaus Kinski.
Well, that is because, according to David Schmoller, he was designed to look like the famous actor. Kinski was one of the director's favorite actors. I've read that in total, the puppets themselves appear in this film for a mere 5 minutes.
That is not all thanks to David Allen's stop-motion wizardry, either. There was a generous portion of practical puppeteering during the film, too.
Projectionist, it took 5 puppeteers to operate Blade. It, of course, wasn't just David Allen, but the members of his production company. I think we should point out that a lot of work went into making sure the puppet themselves, which are mostly silent beyond worried sounds or grunts of exertion and anger, a great deal of effort went into making them move and behave differently from one another. David helped to define their personalities. Now, the title of the movie itself refers to André Toulon. As I've said, he is the actual puppet master, played in this first film by none other than William Hickey. But he's maybe in the movie a total of 5 minutes? Tops. To be fair, the villain in the film earns the puppet master title as well, but it's those creations of André Toulon that are the true stars of the film.
Dear listeners, I will admit that I'm rather shocked that Sage has yet to dive into one of his tiresome synopsis for the film itself. However, perhaps this would be the opportune time to discuss the puppets themselves, eh?
Sure. Thanks for the support as always, my friend.
Anytime, Victor. Anytime.
Okay. I'll make this as direct as possible, listeners, because my love of the puppets of Puppet Master, I could probably go on and on about their backstory from the sequels to the comic book lines and so on.
Oh, yes. You were being so very direct.
Okay, let's start with Blade. This black, wide-brimmed hat and trench coat-wearing assassin is more than slightly unnerving, with his bone-white porcelain features. When he is angered or ready to kill, little spikes emerge from the black holes where his eyes should be. And of course, there is the fact that at the end of his arms, on one, he brandishes a deadly knife blade, and on the other, a wicked metal hook. Bear in mind, these puppets seem to have about as much strength as a small child in some cases. So, when Blade starts stabbing with that knife and ripping away at a victim with that hook, it's brutal. Although, with Pinhead, this creation of Toulon most assuredly has the strength of a full-grown man, thanks to his oversized arms and hands. Which are real hands, by the way. They belong to a dwarf stunt woman named Cindy Sorensen, who you might know as Jeeks, from Disney's Captain EO short film featuring Michael Jackson. Pinhead lives up to his name as he literally has a tiny head, perched atop his 1-foot-tall body. He's barrel-chested and decked out in a red sweater with a face that almost resembles Popeye. Without a doubt, in my mind, he's the bruiser of the bunch, fully capable of pulling someone off their feet and beating them or choking them to death with his fists.
Yes, I enjoyed the effects for this puppet, with Cindy Sorensen providing the hand and arm movement, it helped bring a believable level of threat to Pinhead.
Agreed. Next up is Tunneler. This deadly puppet is pretty easy to identify, as the top of its head literally has a nasty chrome-colored drill, which Tunneler uses to deadly effect by letting it spin up to top speed and then charging into a victim. Imagine for a second waking up to find this little horror sprinting over you and ramming that drill into your face, and you get the idea. Blade and Tunneler both appear to be dressed like German soldiers or members of the SS, with the latter wearing a blue-green military uniform. He also has a decidedly creepy smirk carved into his face. Then there is Leech Woman.
Oh my, dear listeners, this little devil will make your skin crawl and your blood freeze.
Leech Woman's ability is to get ready for it, vomit up large blood-sucking leeches. These leeches appear to be magical in nature, as it doesn't take long for them to suck a victim dry. Leech Woman looks incredibly unhealthy, which I guess is understandable if you are throwing up leeches. There is a gleefully horrible sound when she does this, by the way. She has pale skin, more flesh-colored than Blade's, and has black shark eyes, in addition to blue eyeshadow, and she wears a pink dress. Much like Tunneler, she seems to bide her time and wait for the most opportune moment to strike. Besides those leeches, she also carries a small knife. Fun fact, in some of the original publicity information that was sent out for Puppet Master, she was called Miss Leech. Last, but certainly not least, is my personal favorite puppet, Jester. This puppet looks just like what you think a jester would look like. A court jester, with a dangling hat adorned with bells. While Jester has no weapons to speak of, his gimmick is his face, which are separated in three portions. The forehead, middle of his face, and chin. Perhaps as a means of communicating with his fellow puppets, since they don't speak, these portions will spin for a second and allow him to show different expressions. Like being happy, sad, angry, scared, or even possessing his own rather sinister grin. Jester is the trickster of the group, spying on victims or acting as a distraction, allowing the likes of Blade, Tunneler, or Pinhead to close in and dispatch the target.
I believe our listening audience would be glad you somehow managed to get to the end of your description of the puppet Sage.
Yeah, sorry about that. It will help when I talk about the synopsis. You can picture the puppets in action for yourself, I hope. Speaking of, remember, this is a spoiler-filled synopsis.
Oh, no. Here we go, dear listeners.
The prologue to the film takes place in 1939 at the Bodega Bay Inn, a sprawling oceanside hotel where André Toulon, it seems, has been hiding out. It appears he's being hunted by German spies, who have unfortunately been tipped off to his whereabouts. One of Toulon's last acts, in fact, before he takes his own life, is to bring life to Jester, moments before Toulon kills himself, which is to keep the secret of how he's brought life to these puppets out of German hands. We see Blade racing around the hotel, having seen the spies arrive.
Director David Schmoller wisely decides to use point of view angles for the puppets, so the guests of the Bodega Bay Inn naturally look like giants to Toulon's creations.
Definitely. André Toulon stores his creations in a large traveling case, the inside of which resembles a theater stage, and hides them in a compartment within his room. When the German spies knock on his door, he calmly puts a gun in his mouth and pulls the trigger. We then jump to 1989, where Alex Whittaker, played by American Graffiti's Paul LaMatte, is having a terrible nightmare of an old colleague of his threatening a young woman, putting a gun to her head, as well as Alex experiencing disturbing visions of being covered with giant blood-sucking leeches.
These are visions of the future, dear listeners.
That is exactly what they are, projectionist. You see, Alex is a psychic, and the man in his nightmare, Neil Gallagher, played by Jimmy F. Skaggs, used to be part of a group of fellow psychics. There is the decidedly catty Dana Hadley, portrayed by Irene Miracle, Frank Forrester, played by Matt Rowe, and his lover, Carissa Stamford, played by Catherine O'Reilly. Each of their psychic gifts are different. For example, Dana can predict the future, while Carissa appears to be able to tell you the history of an object she's in contact with. This rather dysfunctional group appears to have all had nightmares or waking visions and believe that it was a message sent by Gallagher. The former colleagues believe the man might have found Toulon's hiding spot and the secret of reanimation at the Bodega Bay Inn.
The hotel appears to have developed a reputation for odd occurrences since Toulon's passing.
Absolutely. Although when they arrive, they are in for quite a shock. For one thing, the hotel is no longer in operation. And secondly, the woman being threatened in Alex's vision is Megan Gallagher, portrayed by Robin Freites, who, as we learn, is Neil's widow. Yes, It appears that her husband has killed himself, leaving instructions with his wife and their one remaining member of the hotel staff that he is not to be buried until after the group arrives. To say there's bad blood in the past between the members of the group and Neil is an understatement. All but Alex appears to not care in the least that Neil has passed away. Dana, Frank, and Carissa are strictly there in hopes they can locate the research that Neil discovered. But listeners, that isn't in the cards, because Neil isn't dead. Besides the fact he terrorizes his former associates and his own poor wife by having his body disappear from its casket to be discovered in various spots in the hotel, Neil has taken Toulon's research and managed to cheat death. The reason he sent a psychic call to his former colleagues appears to have been as a trap. They came to Bodega Bay, where Toulon's puppets under his control could dispatch them, an act of making sure no one that knew of his research could talk about it. He has been granted immortality, and Neil doesn't want to share it.
And the puppets are good at their job, dear listeners.
Frank and Carissa are the first to go, with Tunneler killing the young woman by ramming his drill into her mouth. And Leech Woman dispatches Frank while he's in bed. Teresa, which is the last member of the staff remaining after Neil fired everyone else, is a victim of Pinhead and a fireplace poker. Dana, too, is attacked by Pinhead. The puppet breaks one of her legs while she's sitting in her hotel room. She manages to attempt an escape, constantly trying to fend off the heavy punches of Pinhead as she reaches an elevator, where Blade drops down from the top and nastily slashes her throat. Now, don't get me wrong. Beyond poor Teresa, the likes of Frank, Dana, and Carissa, they aren't exactly likable, but in no way do they deserve to be murdered, or how they're murdered. It's brutal in some cases. Of course, being a horror movie, that is rather the point, right? When Neil reveals he's quite alive, it plays out just like in Alex's vision, threatening Megan with a gun to her head. The two end up brawling, and it's evident that this new body that Neil has constructed is quite a bit stronger, and he is wiping the floor with Alex. The problem for this new puppet master is when he loses his temper and hurts Jester. This has the effect of the other creations of André Toulon deciding to gang up on him and teach him his place, locking him in the elevator where Dana was murdered, and before Alex and Megan's eyes, they absolutely brutalize him, with Tunneler slamming into the back of one of his legs, with Blade slicing off the man's fingers, and Pinhead squeezing Neil's head in a vice-like grip. Even with everything that Neil did, both his wife and Alex cry out for the puppets to stop their attack. But, with the snapping of his neck, the puppet's work is done.
Although this is not the end of Toulon's secrets.
Absolutely right, my friend. As Alex leaves the Bodega Bay Inn, I assume grateful to be away from the place of carnage, we see Megan at the hotel's entrance. You see, for some reason, Dana's character brought along with her a taxidermied dog. A beloved pet, I assume. Megan is holding it when Alex leaves. But as the scene switches, the dog comes to life and follows her up the stairs. Megan, it appears, has learned Toulon's secrets herself and has become the new Puppet Master. And that, friends, is the hopefully brief synopsis for 1989's Puppet Master. With the following sequels and prequels, things are changed. Case in point, when the prologue of the film took place, to even the creation of, say, Jester. In Puppet Master 3, he is with Toulon's other creations. Bear in mind that third film takes place in 1941. So the prologue of 1989's Puppet Master couldn't have taken place in 1939. It's small, nitpicky stuff like this, to be sure, but it doesn't distract from the enjoyment of the film franchise in the least. Now, Projectionist, I believe you've brought the trailer for the listeners to hear, right?
I most certainly have, Sage.
In a house of mysteries.
This hotel seems to have quite a history, Mr. Gallagher.
Who are you people?
A research team with special powers.
My God.
She's experiencing the past.
Because we are all joined by our thoughts.
Has uncovered an ancient secret.
I have something I want to show you.
Metaphysically speaking, I killed myself.
But they are playing with an evil force.
What would you do with the power?
You can't save her, Alex.
They have given life to a deadly power.
We're all in danger.
And now, a box of little toys.
I think someone's in the room, Frank.
Has become a gang of little terrors. Pinhead. Blade. Ms. Leech. Jester. And Tunneler. Irene Miracle, Paul LeMatt, Barbara Crampton, and William Hickey as the Puppet Master.
Friends, there have been, I believe, 12 Puppet Master films to date, and that doesn't include the alternative Puppet Master universe begun with 2018's Puppet Master: The Littlest Reich, which supposedly is getting a sequel entitled Puppet Masters: Aryans Ahoy. These alternate universe films, while still using the basis of what Charles Band and others have created, present a far, far more frightening and gory film universe, featuring André Toulon, who in this case was a Nazi, and uses his army of puppets to do horrible, horrible atrocities. If you like the Puppet Master series, you will probably also like the new series. Although, as I mentioned in the review I did for the film on the Retroist site, there was actually a moment in that film that shocked me so much I had to pause the movie and walk away for a few minutes.
Didn't you mention something to me earlier about Charles Band's brother providing the soundtrack to 1989's Puppet Master?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, and it's a great soundtrack too. Definitely helps to give the film its mood. Here is a very small clip. Listeners, I feel this is a good place to end the show for 1989's Puppet Master. Oh boy. While we can still finish it, thank you again for joining us for the Saturday Frights podcast. The music you heard at the beginning and ending of our podcast was provided by Peachy. If you have musical needs, you can contact him at peachy@retrowest.com. My co-host, The Projectionist, has his own Facebook page, Projectionist Haunted Drive-In. He generally shares old movie posters and newspaper advertisements a couple times a week. It's always neat to see what vintage thing he can dig up to share. Our intern, Rockford J, shares his own love of retro horror every day on the Saturday Frights Facebook page. As for myself, you can still find me posting a couple times a day on not just the Saturday Frights page, but the Diary of an Arcade Employee page too, as well as the Retroist site. I even managed to find time to share some things on the Retroist Clubhouse on Facebook now and again. If you'd like to contact me with suggestions for future episodes, you can reach me at vicsage@retroist.com. Of course, we owe a great deal of gratitude to the Retroist himself, not just for hosting the podcast, but for creating a place where we can all share in our love of things retro. So when you need your retro fix, and we all do, make sure to visit the Retroist. And in closing, if you like the show, please consider giving us a rating over on iTunes or Spotify or however you manage to listen to our show. It really helps to spread the word to new listeners. Take care, friends, and we'll see you for the next show.
Will you please leave?
But as for my insubordination, I was not rude to that woman. Someone should remind her that Christmas is more than barging up and down department store aisles and pushing people out of the way.
Now, Corwin...
Someone has to tell her that Christmas is another thing finer than that.
This has been a Retroist production. Sleep well and goodbye.